This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 27. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's new this week, Mike?
Just looking through the news and finding some interesting stuff, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, are we talking about that stuff today, or is it unrelated to this podcast?
Oh, no, yeah, we'll talk about it, I'm sure.
Okay, but cool.
I don't want to call them growing pains. They're more or less migration pains, though. I'm moving my hosting provider. The hosting plan I was on was, you paid ahead yearly. So last year, I kind of got to the point where I knew I was kind of outgrowing it and didn't really want to stay there because I was running out of disk space and a few other issues as well. But I couldn't upgrade the system at all, and moving to something else would have been a real pain. So at the time, I just didn't do it. And I'm coming up on my yearly renewal again, so I'm looking to move. And it's just, it's a nightmare. I mean, if you've ever changed host providers, it just sucks.
I have. You know, I moved providers for just one website. Wedding Toolbox, I moved it from that dedicated box to my Dreamhost account. And even that, I mean, that's one site, one database. And that took me several hours to get all the configuration. So I think you have multiple sites, right? I mean, that becomes a disaster. Yeah. Yeah, that's such a fiasco. Such a time suck, because it doesn't do anything. You know, it doesn't move you forward. No one notices. It doesn't provide value. So that's a bummer.
And that's the worst thing about it, though, is that if I were to start gauging my time against how much it would cost me to just leave it there, I mean, because the one I'm going to move to is probably like $10 a month cheaper, which honestly, I'm not really concerned about that. It's more the scalability and everything else that goes along with it. But if I were to start logging my time against that as if it were billable, it would just be such a money sink.
I mean, 50-year payback option.
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, it's just ridiculously high. There's no way at all I would ever get the money back based on the time I spend or the money I actually save on that. But you know what? I got to do it. I mean, I'm at the point where I really just don't have any disk space left, and they can't upgrade the system. So
yeah, web hosting is tough like that because it is so cheap that it throws your like hourly monetization metrics way off. It's like you said, you get a 50-year payback or something. But I found, biting the bullet sucks, and you can either pull an all-nighter or you can spend two evenings and just hammer this thing out, or three evenings, whatever it takes you. But like once you're done and it's up and it's clean, and you'll tweak things as you get it up, and so you'll clean a few things up, and it's such a great feeling to be on that new plan and be like, oh, I have unlimited disk space, or you know, whatever your plan has. It's like, it really is a good feeling to know that you're now set up for several years down the line.
Right. I mean, one of the things that, you know, as I said, disk space is one of them, and I've only got like 5 gigs of disk space, which is fine for the most part, but I've started getting into things where I'm going to need a lot more disk space. And then, you know, we actually started out using my host for the podcast that we're currently speaking about. It actually got to the point very, very quickly where I was running out of bandwidth as well. So we ended up moving that, you know, over to your Dreamhost account to host the MP3 files for the podcast themselves. But it went quick. I was surprised at how much bandwidth the podcast used. So
yeah, lesson to anyone out there: if you start a podcast, be on something with unlimited bandwidth or as close to it as you can get. Because yeah, you had quite a bit of bandwidth, if I recall, and you and I were both like, "Oh, it'll be years till you use that," and it was month four or something. And
it wasn't even month four; it was like week four.
You were way. There's a big file, even MP3s, you know, as small as they are. But that eats it up pretty quick. So, hey, I wanted to mention our transcriber, our transcriptionist. I'm not sure what the correct word is, but I was emailing with him a couple weeks ago. And a guy named Brian, he owns a company called transcribenow.net. And he just mentioned, he was like, you know what? If you guys could mention me, I'd appreciate it. So we're not getting any kickback or anything like that. But Transcribe Now, they do transcriptions of audio and video stuff. So just wanted to send a shout out to him. And then I had a question I wanted to pose to you. I've had two people in the last week ask me about whether or not I've produced an audio version of my book, Start Small, Stay Small. And, you know, I had our initial intentions of doing that. like way back in the day when I was writing the book, I was going to release it on Kindle and paperback and audio, just because you and I have a lot of experience doing that and we have editors set up and stuff. And it basically became a time thing. I mean, it's going to take about 12 hours to read it, and it'll probably cost several hundred dollars to edit, probably $500. So I haven't done it. I haven't felt like the demand would be that high. And you and I actually talked about this before, but I had one person a few weeks ago, and then I had two people this week saying, one guy said, I thought you had an audio version. And then another guy said, are you going to do one? Because I'd like to buy it. So I've been toying around with it again and just wondering what your thoughts are on it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, gauging that sort of demand is just difficult because I think in some way you're probably cannibalizing sales from one of the different channels. I mean, if you've got an ebook and you've got a Kindle book and you've got a, you know, a PDF and, you know, and then you've got the audiobook, I think sales of one are going to inevitably cannibalize one of the other channels. And I think that it's gauging what the demand is just going to be difficult. And, I mean, I don't have any experience with publishing an audiobook. I don't know what the demand is for them. I know that for podcasts and stuff, I mean, I listen to podcasts and I use the time that I have like in the car or while I'm out shopping or this or that to listen to podcasts, because generally during the day, I don't really have a whole lot of time that I can dedicate to them. So I can see how that would be helpful. I don't know how much I would listen to something that I actually had to kind of really pay attention to, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wonder, it's tough because, so I do listen to audiobooks and I do pay attention to it. You know, I'm kind of the opposite. I just wonder how many people are out there. I think your comment about cannibalizing other sales is probably a good one, because I think that even, you know, if I release this thing and it sells enough to pay for itself, that's not a guarantee that I wouldn't have sold those in electronic or paperback format. Right. I didn't actually make money just by selling the audio version. I think the question is, will I sell audio version where I otherwise just wouldn't have sold anything? And I think that's impossible to gauge.
I think any audio sales that you get, let's say you get 100 audio sales, that's the maximum. Obviously, that's the maximum additional sales that you're going to get from that, you know, if you're just taking a specific time span or something like that. But there's some percentage of that would probably have been book sales if you did not have an audio version.
Right.
And exactly what that percentage is, I don't know. I mean, it depends on the price point, depends on what other audiobooks go for. I have no idea. I mean, maybe you throw it in with a bundle or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
No idea.
That's what I was thinking. And I think, I mean, I'd like to offer it as a bundle. I think that'd be a big plus. I also like audiobooks because the engagement is there, right? Someone's basically listening to me talk and read my own material. And it really...
Who would want to
do that? Now I know they're out of their mind. I should reply to these three people and be like, what are you thinking? But no, I mean, it's, you know, just like a podcast is so much more engaging than a blog. Even the audience may be 10%, or the sales may be 10% the size of the paperback sales. I think those people who buy it will feel way more kind of connected to the material and potentially connected to my message. So I almost just want to do it because I think it'll be fun. I think it'll be cool to have an audio version, and because it was kind of in the original vision. And it's a gamble. It is a gamble. I could do it. I could spend 12 hours and $500 and just totally not make the time back or the money back. But that's not too bad of a gamble, honestly, assuming I can find the time. You know, when we're recording this 1 week before Business of Software conference, so I'm certainly not going to do it in the next 3 weeks. But I mean, if I can find a long day, I'll just crank it out, you know, in a single day or something. Let's move on. You actually commented that you've been doing a lot more writing. Are you going to start publishing more posts coming off your summer hiatus?
Yep, my wrist is starting to feel a little bit better. You know, I've been having some wrist issues, just, you know, carpal tunnel syndrome, I think, more than anything else. Yeah. So I've tried to really lay off of the mouse quite a lot, and I've considered trying to switch over to, like, using the mouse left-handed. Man, that is so hard.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I can understand how people who are already left-handed can do it, and it's easy for them, but, man, it's really hard to completely relearn that sort of thing. So I basically just decided to stop using the mouse nearly as much. I mean, the interesting part is I can use the keyboard. I can type, but I tend to use the mouse a lot because I edit a lot, move around, and, you know, I switch back and forth between different applications and stuff. So my hand is almost always on the mouse anyway. I've got a bunch of articles that I've been writing. I think I mentioned last week while I was in the airport in San Jose, I was there forever. So I actually got, I think, three articles written while I was there.
So. All right. Well, lay them on us. That's singlefounder.com, folks. Keep your eyes peeled. Very good. Anything else? Any other updates before we move to articles?
Yeah, actually, I got two more things real quick. One is I was very surprised at this. I went out and I bought a new monitor last week, and I bought the brand new Dell Youth 3011. It's like a new 30-inch monitor, you know, 2560 by 1600 resolution.
Nice. Wow.
And I ordered it, I think, on Thursday. I was expecting it either tomorrow or Wednesday, and I noticed this morning that FedEx still shows that the monitor has not shipped. The order's been placed, and obviously Dell knows about it and FedEx knows about it, but it's just not in FedEx's system. So I called Dell this morning and I said, you know, where is this? And they're like, oh, here's your tracking number. I was like, I know, but where is it? And so they went back and started looking through everything, and they said, we're not sure where it is. We think it's still on the dock, but we're going to get you a new one. We're going to give you a replacement, and we're going to overnight it to you. Like, sweet.
Wow. Hopefully that's impressive.
Yeah, and that's why I mentioned it, because I was very impressed that the level of customer service, because I have to be honest, that I would not have expected that from Dell. I really would not have. But I was very pleasantly surprised, I'll say. So I figured I had to share that.
You didn't even have to blog about it and rant at them or anything? Hey, did I ever tell you my Dell story? Because this reminds me of it. It was probably almost 2 years ago. No, it was a little over 2 years ago. And I ordered the laptop I'm speaking on now, and there was something similar to that. There was a shipping mix-up, and it came, and I was pissed, and it took like 2 or 3 weeks to get there, and my other laptop was out of commission, and I was working on some old box. So I was pretty fuming, but I let it go. I've been a Dell man for like 10 years. Then I did my 12 hours of upgrading everything. I got on the new laptop, and 30 days later, the hard drive
crashed. I remember you telling me about this now.
And I was fuming, you know, because even if they replace the hard drive, it's like, oh, another 12 hours for me to move all the data. So it got taken care of, but again, it was a big, long process. And so I blogged about it, and I put just a post that was like, Dell is dead, long live the king, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Dell, the next morning, I got a phone call, and there was a guy, and he said, I think he called himself like, I'm a fixer. And I said, what is that? And he's like, let's just say I'm top-tier tech support. And it was such a trip. It was like something out of Pulp Fiction or something. And he's like, I fix things that are broken. And he's like, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have this overnighted to you AM. It should be there by 6:30 in the morning. You know, and he just started talking. And he's like, here's how I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to have your data moved. I'm going to have this, da, 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 da. And sure enough, it just all went away suddenly. And he's like, if anything goes wrong, or if you need anything from me in the next, you know, year or two, like, here's my 800 number, you call me direct, and this rings to my cell. And it was obvious. I mean, they had seen my blog post. I said, why did you contact me? And he said, oh, someone in corporate said that I should contact you. So it was funny to know that, you know, they're monitoring the blogosphere. So I thought perhaps you were you had posted about this or something.
Maybe this was preemptive. Maybe,
yeah.
You know, that's got to be it. Michael Dell follows my blog. That's
what it is. Yeah.
Him and Stevie J.
Singlefounder.com.
Anyway, the only other thing I wanted to mention is because of all this Entity Framework stuff that I've been going through and learning, I'm a little concerned. And it's not so much about the Entity Framework. It's just more the fact that the product that I'll be talking about more as the episodes go forward and as we get more into that 8 to 12 week guideline that I've been giving you and will probably give you for quite a while.
8 to 12 weeks.
One of the things that concerns me is that there's part of the code that I have. I basically have all the middle tier done, and I have a scripting language that I wrote into the product. And it concerns me just because it basically pulls data out of the idea is to pull data out of the database and then kind of massage that data because it is a scripting language, and then turn around and, you know, execute that scripting language through the engine. And I'm just looking at the Entity Framework saying, yes, I understand how all this stuff works and how you're supposed to do everything, but then I'm looking at, you know, what I'm doing with the data that I'm pulling back, and it's kind of a little scary because I'm looking at it thinking to myself, am I going to have to rewrite part of the guts of my core scripting language in order to accommodate for that? So I'm just not sure about how that's going to turn out so far. So I'm a little worried.
That's a bummer.
Yeah, it may turn into like 12 to 15 weeks.
Well, it's a bummer when underlying technology like that, you know, impacts what you're doing. Obviously, sometimes it can't be avoided, but
I mean, there's ways around it. I could take everything that I'm pulling out of there. I mean, because my scripting language takes an XML data feed, and then I could take everything out of the Entity Framework, turn it into an XML feed, send it into my engine, and then turn around and convert it back to an XML feed and do something like that. I don't know. I'll have to figure something out.
Yeah.
I guess on with the show. What's new this week? What do you want to talk about?
first article I'd like to chat about is a new post by Jason Cohen, and just went live today as of this recording. And it's basically called, "It's Time to Nut Up or Shut Up." You know, he says, "I've been lecturing you about how to build honest, successful bootstrap businesses for a few years, and I had some successes in the past." I mean, he's obviously been pretty damn successful, in my opinion. But he says, "I can't rest on my laurels. I got to start the next one." So he's basically started this company called WP Engine, and he calls it fast, secure, scalable WordPress hosting. And he said they have about 50 customers, and it's high end, right? They're hitting the high end of the market. It's $50 a month, I think, is the basic. It's for one WordPress blog, but it's like super secure, ultra scalable, ultra, you know, all the stuff. I mean, if you have a big blog or something, they're making it the place to go. So I just want to kind of toss this around because I think it's an interesting idea. I mean, I think there's a lot of potential here. Jason said he's going to blog about like how they got the first 50 customers. And, you know, the whole process as they go, I get a little nervous because I can imagine doing this myself. And, you know, Jason's a kind of a personality, right? He's, you know, online, he has popularity, and that makes me nervous. Like, I don't want him to screw up and make a bad decision because then everyone points and says stuff. But I guess that's just the way it goes. And I guess he's good enough to just handle it. I was imagining myself doing this, and it kind of made me nervous. Like, huh? I wonder how transparent I would be with a new product like that. Because you and I talk about our products. You know, I talk about Wedding Toolbox and stuff like that. But I'm not like super ultra transparent with everything I'm doing because I am making mistakes behind the scene. I had an AdWords account and it didn't do that great. You know, I guess how much does that impact someone's credibility? You know, if they make mistakes. The answer is probably it depends, right? How many mistakes they make. And
well, it depends on whether you're successful, ultimately. I think that's really what it comes down to, whether you learn from your mistakes or not.
Right.
So I think that's more it than making mistakes, because everyone makes mistakes. And as you and I have discussed this in the past, as much as some people seem to think, oh, we don't make mistakes, we make the right decisions, we make intelligent decisions. Well, that's garbage. I mean, everybody makes mistakes.
Right.
Everybody adjusts for what they're doing based on information that you learn when you're out in the field. And, you know, you have to do something and then make adjustments. There's no way around it. And what is key to being successful is learning what things are not working as quick as you can so that you can change them and not go as far off track as you probably could. So I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at the WPEngine.com website right now, and I don't know. It's interesting. I'm sure that he's leveraged his contacts to talk to a number of different people and get them to put their blogs there. I think that that's probably a good way to go. I mean, he's basically just leveraging his, I don't want to say popularity, but his reach.
Right, his audience.
Yeah.
And that's what some of the commenters on his post said, because he basically said, oh, I'm going to kind of man up and do it myself and build a business and show you that I can do it, or show myself. Or, you know, he's kind of just talking like, I'm going to really do it. And then people in the comments are like, well, it's not really fair because you have an advantage because you have this whole audience thing. And he's kind of like, well, you know, they were kind of just bouncing it back and forth. And it was an interesting discussion. Is it truly a level playing field if he's kind of utilizing his audience?
I think it is, though, because there's nothing to say that you can't build up that audience yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, because what has he done? And I'm not trying to minimize his past accomplishments, but I'm talking specifically about his blog. I mean, he's created a blog by writing a bunch of posts, and sure, he sold his previous companies, and that's gotten him some notoriety and gotten some people to listen. But there are other people out there, and I don't want to call this person out to, you know, just to call somebody out and say, what has he done? But, you know, Jeff Atwood, if you look specifically at him, he's got a blog and he's got well over, what is it, 100,000 subscribers?
Yeah,
or something like that.
I think he's at 150 now. The guy's nuts. He's
right.
Awesome.
As of 2 or 3 years ago, he had not started a company. He had not sold a company. Whereas right. You compare him to Jason Cohen and you look at the subscriber numbers, I mean, basically all they're doing is they're continuously writing, they're continuing to be intelligent about what they write about, basically just gathering audience over time. There's nothing that says that anybody else who has half a brain couldn't do the same thing. And as long as you're a reasonably decent writer and you have intelligent things to say, people are going to listen.
Yeah, I think it's hard, man. Because like Jeff Atwood has 150,000. Jeff Atwood is my friend. I'm not sure if I'm his friend. No, but he and I have emailed several times and he's offered me advice and we've chatted about stuff. dude, I mean, he was super consistent. He and I actually started our blogs within a month or two of each other. And we used to, back when we were both nobodies, I'm still a nobody. We used to link back and forth to each other's posts, and we were kind of up and coming programming bloggers. And he just kept, he was so consistent. He was like two or three times a week. And I was like once a week or once every 10 days. And so he had consistency. And his writing has a different style. I mean, he's just he's a better writer than I am. And he always had fantastic, focused, niche content and basically, you know, worked his ass off. And I feel like Jason Cohen has done the same thing. His businesses gave him initial credibility, but you read the stuff he writes and it just makes a lot of sense. And that's why we all read his blog. He's been gaining like 1,000 RSS subscribers a month for a year. I mean, it's insane. Like he really hit a high trajectory. I would kill for that, you know? I think I put on 500 or 600 in a month once, you know, and that's like my peak time. And so I think there's more to it than just being a good writer and just having some good content. I mean, there's a lot of consistency and a lot of other stuff, but you're right. I hate to say anyone could do it, but anyone who worked hard enough and had certain skills could do it.
Right. I think along with that, it's just a matter of focusing on building that audience, because I don't see it as being a lot different than what angel-funded and VC-funded companies do. They basically go for eyeballs and they try and get as many people using their product as humanly possible. And that's the same thing you would do with building a blog. And you would try and build up an audience as quickly as you can and as big as you can. And then you figure out how to monetize it. And that's what all these startup companies do, is because they don't know exactly how they're going to make money. They just have an idea that they know a lot of people are going to use. They'll figure out how to make money from it later. And you can do the same thing with a blog if you are so inclined. I certainly don't want to make people think that, oh, the only reason to have a blog is to make money. There's a lot of other reasons to have a blog. I mean, I certainly don't have my blog to make money off of it, although, you know, I probably could if I really wanted to. But I also don't pour a ton of time and effort into my writing or my blogging in order to get massive numbers of followers so that I can then turn around and make money from them somehow. But if I had 100, 150,000 subscribers, I'm pretty sure I could figure out how to turn, you know, that into a gold mine.
Right, right.
It just depends on how much effort and time that you're willing to put into building that blog audience.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that building a blog to that order of magnitude is like doing a startup. It's a part-time job. You know, I wouldn't say it's full-time because I know Atwood did it on the side, and I know that Jason Cohen has done it on the side as well. But it's not something that you kind of just do on and off for 6 months. You know, it's like 10, 20 hours a week for a year to kind of get the ball rolling. So yeah, WP Engine, I'm interested to see if it flies. They have 50 people using it. I imagine, you know, if it becomes the name in WP hosting, they could have something here because WordPress is so popular these days. So I would give it, my prediction is that it will be successful. I don't know. I have a hard time imagining it'll be like a multi-million-dollar company. I guess at $50 a piece, that's a lot of customers to sign up. But
well, he's also got a $500 a month plan. So
oh, nice.
Yeah.
We're in the wrong business, man. I don't have any apps that are $500 a month plan.
I think he'll do well with it.
I think Jason's the kind of guy that anything he does is going to succeed in some way or another. Like he'll either pivot and do something else. I mean, I just don't see him shutting it down, especially with the team they have working on it. It's not like it's going to fail. You know, they're going to go belly up.
Right.
They'll figure something out and make it work.
One, it came out this past week, the Stuxnet worm. Did you hear about that?
I didn't.
Interesting. If you don't really pay attention to security, you might not have heard it, but the Stuxnet worm is basically this internet worm that went out and it targets manufacturing hardware. And more specifically, I found this one extremely interesting because it was targeting nuclear reactors. And it infected a bunch of them. Iran is one of the countries who has been, people are kind of theorizing that they were targeted for this. Symantec Corporation, I guess, looked into the code itself and said that it would probably take a well-funded team of 5 to 10 individuals at least 6 to 10 months to build. And that was a conservative estimate. So whoever built this worm, it was probably a very, very well-funded, either private group of individual or government entity. And I thought that this was interesting, not really because of the political ramifications around this, but because if you're targeting something like a nuclear reactor with viruses or worms and things like that, I could see a very viable and probably very lucrative business springing up around building software that fights against this sort of stuff. What do you think? Because these machines that are being targeted are running nuclear reactors, and one of the goals of the worm was to modify their behavior in almost imperceptible amounts that would basically screw up the things that they're working on.
Wow, that's pretty scary.
What's even scarier is that after running three times, it deletes itself. So the idea was that it would have gone in, screwed stuff up, and then self-deleted, and you never would have found it. The damage would have been done, and you would have no idea why.
So it's like terrorism through a virus, essentially, right? I mean, they're trying to get something to explode or have a core reaction.
Something like that. I mean, it's also a lot of it's speculation at this point.
Right.
But I found the business implications behind that of finding a new business. I mean, there's a whole market right there that's almost emerging kind of before our eyes.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you think Symantec or someone's going to do something about this? Sophos, you know, the guys whoever puts out virus scanning software right now, doesn't seem like they'd be on this.
I don't think they will.
No?
And the reason is because for the same reason that no other large company does that sort of stuff, they will find a small startup company that starts that business and they'll find the market leader and then they'll buy them. That's what will happen.
Got it. So that's what you're saying. That's your new idea. 10 to 12 weeks, right?
Yeah, right.
That would be brutal.
So today's listener question is from Jason Billingsley. And he writes, Rob and Mike, at the beginning of this year, before I found your podcast, mind you, I started looking into building a website to create a revenue stream. After seeing Sortfolio.com from 37 Signals, I thought this kind of site could be beneficial to small graphic design firms and freelancers. I did my research, putting up a quick test site that received a promising response, then went to building out the site. What I'm facing now is huge competition in PPC, which is cost ineffective, and the fact that for the site to succeed, it needs to reach two separate audiences, people who hire graphic designers and the graphic designers who will pay to be listed on the site. Neither party finds value in the site without the other, especially designers who pay for a listing and get no new work from it. I thought a freemium model was the solution to this problem, but I'm not so sure now. Do you have any insights into building these audiences concurrently, or have I run into an unescapable paradox of micropreneurial death? Love the podcast. Keep up the good work. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, this is painful. Trying to build up network effect as a micropreneur, as a solo entrepreneur, is ridiculously hard. I always recommend against this, actually. Unless you have an audience already, whether through a blog or something, it's too hard to even build up one side of this fence unless you have venture capital or a whole team who's focusing on this thing. If you see, you know, like eBay when they were building their network effect early on in 96 or anything that launches today where they try to get two sides of the coin, they have entire teams dedicated to this. There's just no chance that you're going to do it unless you already have one side of that coin. And if you look at 37 Signals, they already had at least one side of that, right? They have 120,000 readers or something in their blog, or 120,000 subscribers for that matter. A whole heck of a lot of them are designers. And I would imagine a whole heck of a lot of them hire designers, frankly. So they just had the instant network effect. It's the same thing Joel did with his job board. But trying to start a job board just with no blog and no audience or anything takes a lot of money and time. So from the sound of it, it sounds like we have a couple things going on. You're a single founder, you're trying to do, you know, a network effect startup, which is going to be nigh impossible as a solopreneur. And it sounds like, Mike, did you hear that it was differentiated from Sortfolio at all? Because it seems like it's kind of a Me Too thing with Sortfolio.
And it did sound like that.
Yeah. So if it's the same business model and it's just for smaller designers or it's cheaper or something like that, you know, that's another strike against it. It doesn't sound like there's much differentiation there. So that's my take on it. It's just my opinion, but I think this one's it's not only an uphill battle, I just think it's going to be, has the odds stacked highly against it. What do you think?
Well, I think the first thing I should do is probably actually mention the URL to it, because that might help out a little.
That would be good. Then I could actually look at the site. Yeah. What is it?
It's www.graficio.com, I think. GRAFICIO.com. I think you're right. As you said, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any real differentiation between this site and, you know, any other site where you would find graphic designers.
I think the difference is Sortfolio, it says web designers, and Graficio says graphic designers. And I realize that's a subtlety, but Graficio is more for print designers.
Right.
I think that's the big differentiator. And I'd imagine there are going to be a lot of graphic designers on Sortfolio. They're going to go where the network is. In addition, you know, there's going to be more web designers online I mean, I know graphic designers are online, certainly, but if they really are only print designers and don't consider themselves web designers, it's going to be an even harder market to reach than what 37 Signals went after.
I would actually disagree with that, because I think that if you specifically target print designers, any company that needs a print graphic designer, I don't know of any place out there where you could go to find them. I mean, yeah, you can go to Craigslist or Monster.com or Dice and find people that way. But I would seem to think that if you were to kind of try and make this into an actual micropreneur business where you're going to target people who are specifically interested in a print graphic designer, which you're essentially putting a niche on the market saying, I'm only going after the print ones. If you're looking for a web designer of any kind, that's not what we do. But I think you could probably zero in on, you know, like magazines, for example. You know, any magazine that's looking for graphic designers to help with, you know, either images or image manipulation or layout or anything like that, and specifically go after magazines. And magazines are just an example. You could also say we kind of cater to people who are looking for print designers who deal with a specific type of marketing collateral, whether those are brochures or flyers or what have you. So I think that that's probably the way I would go. The other thing that I might seriously consider is, because of the fact that this is really a chicken and egg problem, I don't think that you can charge for this at all up front. I think that you almost need to make it free for a while and then switch over to starting to charge people for putting them together.
Yep. No, I'll agree with that.
I don't like that idea, to be perfectly honest, because I think it puts you in an uncomfortable situation where it used to be free and now it's not. And how do you justify making it a paid service when before it wasn't? And your justification is, well, it's got a network effect now, so it's actually worth it. You come here for your graphic designers, so it's obviously worth it for you to do so. And if it's not, then, you know, you don't have to come here anymore. But if you can get enough graphic designers who are going to the site to look for jobs, and you're pairing enough of them up for free after 6 months or 10 months or something like that, if you're able to turn it around and you've got the sustained traffic coming in, you can start charging people. Or you can find other ways to allow them to collaborate somehow, and you charge them for that collaboration. I think that once you get the traffic, there are ways to figure out how to make money from it. But you've got to get the traffic first, and I think charging is probably a barrier to entry to that. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that you have to fund the business until it gets to that point, and that almost makes it more of a angel VC startup sort of scenario. Depends on how big it gets and how quickly.
Yeah, I think now that I've looked at the site and everything, I hear you that I wonder if there are other resources. I mean, I'd have to go to Google and type in find a graphic designer. But that's the first thing I would do, is try to SEO this and get to the top result for terms like that, find a graphic designer. Because if you bring the buyers, the sellers, meaning the graphic designers, they will flock to you. Absolutely. I mean, that's what happens in any market. So if you can focus and either use AdWords, which is not a sustainable strategy, I bet, in this case, looks like there's a lot of AdWords for it. But if you can SEO for that thing and you can get several thousand people a month and they're, you know, clicking on and hiring these designers, then you will have such little problem contacting graphic designers and saying, we've already sold $100,000 or $500,000 worth of work, and we already get 10,000 or 20,000 uniques a month looking for these specific things. Then it's a no-brainer, and it's like, sign up for $50 a year or $100 a year, whatever you're going to charge. So that's what I would focus on, is, like Mike said, making it free for the designers, trying to get it. It looks like you have a reasonable seed right now of designers. I mean, obviously you want to build that up. It doesn't look like it's just totally empty at this point. If you continue to build that for free and just try to use network effect and blogs and contacts and such, and then use all your paid resources to actually bring the buyers, I think you're going to be a lot better off.
So thanks for the question, Jason. And I think that about wraps it up for today's episode. If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. A full transcript of this podcast is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.